This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with journalist Max Rivlin-Nadler on what Trump could legally get away with. Will it be a Trump apocalypse? Let's give a listen. We'll also hear an update from Native American attorney Angela Bibbins on what's been going on in the attacks against the water protectors up in North Dakota. The project is stalled for now, but will it remain so under Trump?
We'll speak with screenwriter Zachary Sklar about Oliver Stone's film, Snowden.
This is a riveting film, which we encourage everybody to see. And if you read a bad review, be suspicious of its author.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Donald Trump will be sworn into office on January 20th as the 45th president of the United States. He will begin his term with a Republican Congress. What can he do legally? What powers does he possess that would victimize immigrants, women, minorities, the infirm, political activists, and journalists? We speak today with journalist Max Rivlin-Nadler. He is an independent journalist based in New York City. His work is focused on urban affairs and criminal justice issues. He's the author of the recent article which appeared in The Gothamist called Trumpocalypse Now, What's the Worst That Could Happen in New York City? Max, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
You know, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, it's a chilling name. ICE, here in New York City, we have a sanctuary city, but ICE, we can't prevent ICE from conducting their operations. Should we be scared?
I would argue communities, immigrant communities, have often been aware of the threat that ICE poses in the New York City, and kind of not the hollowness necessarily of the idea of a sanctuary city, but that the protections don't go near far enough. ICE is incredibly aggressive in tracking down undocumented immigrants or immigrants that are considered enforcement priority, which include people with previous convictions. The Obama administration was incredibly aggressive in its deportation apparatus and has really built a very strong and extensive network through ICE, which to track and arrest immigrants.
What kind of records do they have access to?
When somebody, for example, when somebody is arrested in New York City, when they get brought to central booking, they are fingerprinted. Those fingerprints are then shared with the FBI, who in turn shares it with the Department of Homeland Security, which is what houses ICE. So they have access to anybody who's been fingerprinted by the NYPD, as well as their home address and any of your criminal convictions and your criminal rap sheet. In addition to that, the FBI has access to a number of databases that the city itself keeps. One of the things that people are really scared of is the ID NYC project, which tried to get municipal IDs and did successfully to thousands of New Yorkers, especially undocumented individuals, to give them some level of access to city services could actually fall into the hands of the FBI, which, you know, if the FBI decides this is something they want, they can pursue.
What kind of detention facilities currently exist?
Right now, there's one in downtown Manhattan. There's one in Queens. There's a few in New Jersey. There's a private facility in New York City itself. These are run for a large proportion of the country by corporations, private corporations like Correctional Corporation of America, which has since rebranded after it got some bad press over the summer. ICE also works with county jails. Right now, New York City jails are not incredibly cooperative with ICE, but if you go upstate or if you go into New Jersey or any of the more conservative areas of this metropolitan area, you will find ICE holding immigrants and people that they want to target for enforcement action in counties across the area.
You could make the more general point that what's applicable to people here in New York City is applicable around the country.
Yeah, things that I often hear from activists and immigrant groups across the country is, you know, welcome. This is something we've been dealing with, which is enhanced enforcement and cooperation from local law enforcement for years, and especially has increased during the Obama administration.
Let's talk about habeas corpus, the great writ, hundreds of years old, allows people to challenge their detention and get in front of a judge. Can that writ of habeas corpus be suspended by Trump?
only in very, very rare instances and not without the consent of Congress. There's been examples in the past where presidents in times of war have lifted this and then retroactively gone to Congress for permission. But as you'll see in a number of issues, presidents have taken a lot of latitude in what they consider to be done, themselves capable of, and then only later ask for permission or wait for somebody to tell them to stop. In a situation where all three branches of the government are effectively under conservative control, this could get kind of dicey.
What about Trump's ability to declare war? The Constitution says that war can only be declared by Congress, but that hasn't been followed for decades. Mm-hmm. What do you think will happen with Trump?
Well, the Obama administration has greatly expanded the battlefield globally. Bush obviously launched us into two long and costly wars, whereas Obama has shifted the battlefield deep into Africa and pretty much every corner of the world into these small actions and things that we don't hear about and certainly that Congress doesn't get asked for. Trump could continue those types of incursions into other nations' sovereignty, either through no-fly zones, airstrikes, or direct assistance to militaries. It's a scary thought and something that has a very bad precedent.
Yeah, another scary thought was when Anwar al-Awlaki was executed. He was a guy that was born in New Mexico, was an American citizen. Then 2 weeks later, his 16-year-old son was executed. Could Trump continue doing these executions abroad?
Absolutely. There's nothing that has stopped President Obama from doing it. There's nothing that could conceivably stop President-elect Trump from doing it unless Congress decides to intervene in some meaningful way.
What about the threat of a Muslim registry?
Well, this week, the Obama administration effectively shuttered and destroyed, or have said they will destroy, a program called NSEERS, which was a program created during the Bush administration to register and track people entering from Muslim countries, Muslim-majority countries into the U.S. This was never really used by the Obama administration. They kind of mothballed it, but it did exist and did impact people's lives during the Bush administration. Now it has been destroyed. So theoretically, and again, we don't see any of these things, but theoretically, if Trump was to pursue a Muslim registry, he would have to begin technically from scratch.
Well, who designed the Muslim registry?
The Muslim registry, one of the top designers was Chris Kobach, who was, I believe, a U.S. attorney at the time. He himself is a very hard right conservative thinker. He's one of the designers of the SB 1070 bill in Arizona, which kind of legalized racial profiling. He's been Trump's go-to immigration guru, as it were. And he was even caught walking into Trump Tower showing off his outline for plans last month, which included things like tracking of Muslims as well as detaining people and putting them subject to deportation just based on an arrest. So Chris Kobach is a scary guy, and he is very capable of designing a similar program. He's already done it.
What do you think of the idea that's been floated? People like our listeners, in an act of solidarity, go up and register as Muslims. Can we do that?
I think it's a really nice idea, and we need more acts of solidarity like that over the next 4 years, but it's not necessarily how previous registries worked. You don't sign up, you get put on them. That's how the no-fly list works. That's how a lot of the way the government compartmentalizes and decides which people it wants to keep an eye on and prosecute, as it were.
During the Second World War, tens of thousands of Japanese American citizens were picked up and put in concentration camps. And the Supreme Court ruled on the legality of that, 6-3, saying that that was a legitimate thing to do. And that decision has never been overturned. Do you think it's going to be operative in the future?
Legal scholars for decades and directly in the immediate aftermath of that decision have frowned upon it as not only being wrong, but also not really having much in terms of precedent. It would be a huge shift away from years and years of what the court has decided since then in terms of indefinite detention and arbitrary detention of individuals. If the Trump administration were to make an argument that based on that decision, they would be able to intern, you know, thousands or millions of people, they would have a long uphill battle that would be met at every point by legal organizations and advocacy groups. I just don't see it holding much water.
Let's turn our attention to health care. What happens to young people if Obamacare is repealed?
Nobody knows at this point. The Republicans in the House have been kind of cagey about what exactly they want to do. They say, we want to repeal Obamacare, but not any of the stuff that gives you coverage. That is walking an incredibly fine line, seeing as though much of the mechanisms of Obamacare allow young people to be covered. The one thing that they've enjoyed and that they want to keep and that has been widely used has been allowing young people to stay on their parents' health care plans till they're 26. Republicans have a voice that they would want to keep that intact, but other programs like the Essential Plan, which is offered in New York State, which covers thousands of young people over the age of 26 who don't make that much money, who live in our five boroughs. There's a lot of these people, and that's how they're getting health care. And once the Essential Plan is dismantled, which is a signature of Obamacare, you're going to see a lot of uninsured people.
What about Medicaid? There are millions of people in New York City that get Medicaid and tens of millions across the country of poorer people that get some assistance. Can the new administration take this away?
The new administration single-handedly can't. However, Congress can. That's been one thing that Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, has had high on his agenda, which is shifting Medicaid from need-based assistance from the federal government. So the states go, hi, we have this many people who use Medicaid and we'll need this much money. And that's usually met under the new Paul Ryan supermajority, as it were. He has said that he wants to switch to block grants. Block grants would limit the amount that states would be able to spend on coverage and really hinder New York State's ability to insure its most vulnerable and poor populations.
What about protecting women? 53% of the women that voted for Trump. You think the next 4 years are going to be scary for women? I mean, what about Roe versus Wade? What was that decision about? And you think that could be overturned?
Roe v. Wade guaranteed the right to an abortion in the United States. This has been precedent for 50 years. This has been the law of the land. But I think women would tell you across the country that in practice, much of what we're going to see nationwide has already been put into place in conservative states, limiting the ability of Planned Parenthood to operate, limiting funding opportunities, putting in really punitive and kind of sadistic practices like having people to hear the heartbeat before they have an abortion or bury the fetus that's been aborted.
That was Pence, a cremation or a burial for a fetus.
Right. So to see this nationally, you're going to see that a lot more nationally, but it's been happening at a state level for decades.
What about surveillance issue. Can the government really spy on our every move?
Surveillance is something we should be really apprehensive about. The Obama administration has been especially aggressive. The security state does have its hands in many of our communications. No matter what you think of him, Edward Snowden did expose a good amount of what the government said it wasn't doing, but it is in fact doing. That means we can't necessarily take the government at its word, which is always a scary proposition and actually should be the status quo. But the idea people should get used to the idea that your communication is being monitored and somebody is listening to it, and you need to take steps to increase your security and discretion.
Can the Trump administration force New York to bring back stop and frisk?
The Trump administration cannot do that. Local law enforcement is a matter of the state that's been delegated to the states, which in turn is delegated to the cities or the people that work and to manage police departments. He can't do that as much as he'd like to, and you know, that's just the end of that.
Good. And, so, and what about journalists, people such as yourself, Max? Can the government, and Trump has been threatening this, can the government go after journalists?
In the United States, we have extremely strong First Amendment laws. We have robust freedom of the press. However, that is as limited as the discretion of the prosecution, the Department of Justice. The Obama administration has tried more people on the Sedition Act than every other president, I believe, combined. This should be alarming to people who report on national security affairs or domestic affairs. This should be something that needs to remain unacceptable, should have been unacceptable during the Obama administration. And now that the precedent has been set, as we see in so many cases, we should truly be alarmed. Shield laws should be much, much stronger. There should be a federal shield law allowing journalists to protect their sources. And unfortunately, we've seen a weakening of these over the past several years.
Well, the Woodrow Wilson administration back 100 years ago at the time of the First World War passed the sedition law. And in fact, they put Eugene V. Debs into prison for speaking out against the war. And that law is still on the books, so that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's a scary thought that we haven't gotten around to setting good practices in government. We've allowed things to slide because people enjoy what the Obama administration was able to project. And it's a scary time to think now that a man truly bent on wielding power unilaterally has been handed quite a robust set of tools.
You know, there's a famous saying in American politics that all politics are local. That being true, what can local people do to stop or even reverse these anticipated horrors?
Quite a bit. As we saw in during the Obama administration, emboldened Republican leaders decided that non-cooperation was the best way forward for them, and certainly it paid huge dividends. I think once you begin making deals with Trump, this is something that he does. He makes deals. You're going to see a weakening of your ability to negotiate or defend the things that you hold dear. New York City, the mayor Bill de Blasio, has been incredibly firm in his stance of resistance to Trump. Then again, he doesn't actually have much power in that dynamic. That would fall to the governor, Andrew Cuomo, who's stuck a defiant but ultimately more conciliatory tone with Trump. We'll work with him on things we agree on. We'll defend the things that we appreciate and value. And you certainly haven't seen that happening in a state like California, where the governor, Jerry Brown, has been unusually defiant for a governor in terms of the president, especially a Democrat in terms of the president, kind of signaling that even climate research would continue under his government, and California would move unilaterally forward in a progressive direction, completely contradictory to what the federal government will be doing.
What about the Drug Enforcement Agency and drug laws? Because we've made tremendous progress recently in decriminalizing drugs and harm reduction. Nevertheless, the federal government still has laws against, say, marijuana, which they classify in the same league with heroin, while there are other places like Colorado that say it's perfectly legal. But the federal law is still in place. And what do you envision with that contradiction?
Yeah, I mean, states have moved much faster than the federal government in normalizing and legalizing marijuana, a drug that is not harmful. A healthy majority of doctors will tell you that, you know, this is doesn't have a huge impact on your health and could be quite medicinal in cases. Unfortunately, the federal government still treats it incredibly harshly, and under the Department of Justice, under a man like Jeff Sessions, who has been incredibly hard on crime, incredibly spiteful towards people of color and minority communities, this could be used as a tool to drive back up incarceration. People, the federal government can classify even smaller amounts of marijuana as a serious crime. Worthy of serious time in federal prison. And that is something to be aware of and watch out for. And the federal government could absolutely begin cracking down on states that have legalized it and have seen economic booms because of it. This is something, again, that the Obama administration chose not to tackle and would have been very helpful moving into what promises to be a dark, dark time.
Yeah, Jeff Sessions is the upcoming attorney general. There are two issues that we've talked about continually on Law and Disorder. One has been the closing of Guantanamo, and the other has been prosecuting torturers, because torture is illegal under both American and international law. Obama failed to both close down Guantanamo or to prosecute the torturers under the rubric, we have to look forward, not backward. So do you think that there's a possibility that Guantanamo will still be there? Trump has bragged about filling it up. And also, Trump says that torture works, and we're going to do stuff worse than waterboarding. What do you project in that area?
It's tough to say. A lot of these things happen in the shadows. We need good journalists to suss out exactly what happens when someone is detained who's not an American citizen, who's not entitled to the rights that we enjoy as Americans. To guess what he's going to do is very tough. He says contradictory things. He has stated repeatedly that he enjoys enhanced interrogation methods. Let's take him at his word for that and really pay attention to what they're doing. Obama has promised, or at least I was listening to his press secretary the other day, that there will be further people released before January 20th from Guantanamo Bay. I think at this point, to believe that it will be at all closed before then or is fantasy. It's still going to be at Trump's disposal, and that is a huge failing of the Obama administration, which promised to close Guantanamo Bay well within its first term.
And could have done that. He's the commander-in-chief. He could have done that unilaterally and did not.
Yeah, and you'll see that quite a bit.
It's really been a pleasure to speak with somebody as well-informed as you, and we're grateful for your coming on Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Yeah, no. Here's hoping for the best, but preparing for the worst.
Thanks, Max. Water protectors, numbering in the thousands, including members of more than 100 Native American tribes at Standing Rock, North Dakota, have been brutally and continually attacked since they began their encampment months ago. They are stationed in the freezing North Dakota weather and have succeeded in halting the construction of a 1,200-mile oil pipeline that's scheduled to go through sacred Indian lands and beneath the Missouri River, and then through South Dakota, Iowa, and into Illinois. Pipelines frequently break, and if and when this one does, it'll contaminate the water supply of some 15 million people. Water from the river was sprayed on protesters in 26-degree weather, causing many of them to get life-threatening hypothermia. Recently, there have been reports of low-flying airplanes releasing poison on the tents where the people are encamped. There have also been reports of snipers training their rifles on the people in the camp. President Obama has temporarily stopped the construction of the pipeline. It's a $3.8 billion project owned by the Energy Transfer Partners, an outfit which Donald Trump has a large investment in. Our guest today is attorney Angela Bibbins, a Native American from Denver, Colorado. She practices criminal law, juvenile and family law, with a specialty in the Indian Child Welfare Act. She earned her law degree from the University of Denver and is a wife and a mother of three children. Angela has been on the ground coordinating the Water Protector Legal Collective at the Ossetti Sakowin Camp near the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe for the past 3.5 months. She joins us today to give us an update. Angela, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hey, honey, Westay. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. You're back home in Colorado now, but you were at the camp. Tell me what it was like there and how you're feeling.
When I left about a week and a few days ago, it was still pretty cold. It had warmed up, though, from negative 15 to 20 above freezing, so or above zero. So it was feeling rather balmy the last day that I was actually in camp.
How is it there now? I mean, what's it like for those people that are camped out there, and how many people are left?
Sure. So there was a Christmas Day blizzard that left a good 6 to 12 inches of snow with 4-foot snowdrifts in some places, so travel was made impossible for a couple of days. I think the roads are clear now, and people are starting to move around again. Snowmobiles have popped up in camp, which are really useful, especially the Medic and Healing Council have had a few donations of snowmobiles, and that's really good for safety. We even have a couple of folks, volunteers on the legal team, who also, they're veterans, and they also do some of those safety and wellness checks using snowmobiles. So that's been really great that people have come to the support of camp in that way. The camps have shrunk. So there are three main camps, Sacred Stone Camp, Rosebud Camp, and now called Ocheti Oyate Camp, or All Nations Camp, which was formerly Ocheti Shakowi Camp, the Seven Councils Fire, Council Fire Camps. And so when I left, the two big camps, Sacred Stone and Ocheti Oyate, were about 700 people each, and Rosebud was about 300. So we're under 2,000, but probably still above 1,000.
And we heard from one of our affiliate stations, WGRN in Greenville, Illinois, our producer Jeff Brady was talking to a woman out there, and she reported there are unmarked planes spraying something on the encampment at night. What do you know about that?
Well, I've been there since August, and so I've grown accustomed to the flyovers. Helicopters often start as early as 6 a.m. Sometimes they don't end well into the night or 24 hours a day even. What happened with the flyovers and this association of maybe so they maybe were being, you know, treated with some kind of chemical at the camp, they're spraying something, people started cropping up with some respiratory issues and some other issues. The Medics and Healing Council have enough sophisticated medical equipment on camp to be able to test people's blood, and they come up with some abnormalities for a few folks. And on the night of November 20th, when this unmarked plane, this gray white plane, had just been flying over continuously for hours and hours along with a helicopter, I actually sent a team of folks from the legal team, volunteers, with some pretty crude instruments like Q-tips, kitchen gloves, and Ziploc bags to go and swab different areas of the camp, like the school, the Medics and Healing Council area, Media Hill, all the kitchens, like all the way over at Sacred Stone Camp and Rosebud Camp. And that's been about 7 weeks now. We're still looking for a lab to help us analyze those samples. In addition, we had a councilwoman from Minneapolis who took some soil samples up at the Backwater Bridge and is having those analyzed. And now people are, you know, who are coming to camp in the winter are getting this dapple cough, including myself, I'm on week three of trying to get over this, even though I'm taking a break at home in Colorado. It's lingering like no other cold I've ever had before. So it does make me suspicious. We don't have anything to substantiate that we've actually been subjected to some kind of chemical warfare, but it's risen to the level of needing to investigate, at least to put those rumors to bed if it's not true.
And what about another way to intimidate people. We've heard reports that there are snipers training their rifles on the people in the encampments.
I have also heard those reports from various sources in camp. And what has been told to me is that there are different vantage points outside of camp in which snipers are stationed. And while, you know, they are using actual semi-automatic weapons, it's really the scope that they're using to be able to see what's going on in camp. I mean, we've known for months, I've known for months that, you know, because I've lived there, that's my second home, that we're under constant surveillance. And while it's alarming to think that there's somebody who's armed with that level of a deadly weapon that is training their eye on camp at all times, it's also just sort of become part of the landscape that this is a war zone and people are, you know, kind of accustomed to it, even though we really shouldn't be.
And what about the massive arrests? There have been some 570 arrests since August, and the local papers reporting that the special prosecutor, Ladd Erickson, said he wants the people been arrested to pay for the attorneys that have been appointed to defend them. Can you tell us the status of all these criminal cases?
Sure. So we have had our first two convictions, which occurred last Tuesday. There were 10 people set for trial on Monday, and the special prosecutor had violated a discovery rule by releasing very late in the game about 3 hours of digital evidence, and he released it only to one attorney prior to the trial date. And so, reluctantly, the judge had to order that the motion to continue by the defense be granted because of this clear violation. So, you know, the prosecutor's kind of playing fast and loose with a lot of the rules here, not only constitutional violations, not only, you know, abuse of prosecutorial discretion, in my opinion, but other abuses. He had filed a motion in limine to exclude any defenses, to exclude any reference to sacred sites, to treaty rights, to sovereignty, to Dakota access as a potential bad actor, to any kind of justification or necessity defense. How can that be constitutional? We have no right to mount a reasonable defense on behalf of the water protectors. Clearly, that's not conscionable. So the judge did acknowledge that the special prosecutor could make objections when these things were raised in front of the jury, but that they could not be excluded. And as to the fees, the folks who were convicted of misdemeanors on Tuesday were assessed $500 each to pay their attorneys. Their attorneys objected, saying that they had not made any record of their expenses on these cases. It's very preposterous that the special prosecutor would think that any one water protector has any personal financial link to the defense fund that has been raised. That money is there for the general good and only exists in response to what Morton County has put everybody through, that there are going to be tremendous financial and personal liabilities as a result of their overbearing response at the front lines, and now the new front lines, which is the courtroom. It continues, and the public has responded with this support because they know how unfair and how unjust what's going on in North Dakota is.
We're speaking with a Native American attorney, Angela Bibbins, who's the head of the Water Protectors legal team up in the North Dakota. Angela, what do you think's going to happen when Trump on January 20th takes office? Obama put a temporary halt on digging the pipeline, but that could all stop. What kind of concerns do you and people up there have about that?
I think we're all very concerned. I have been in touch with one of the attorneys for the tribe, it seems that it does take a lot of, you know, administrative wrangling to reverse a kind of agency decision that the Army Corps has halted and is reviewing this request for the water crossing easement, the 404 permit, and whether they need to do an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement. That's what I understand about it. And so it would take a lot to overcome that process. But I don't put anything past the Trump administration to be able to have the political wrangling internally to reverse what the Obama administration has done. And I think that's why our clients, the water protectors, have remained at camp. There are a couple of deadlines, the January 1st deadline in which Enbridge was going to become fully invested in the Dakota Access Pipeline. Now I've read from the Bismarck Tribune that you know, there are signs that that relationship may be on the rocks, that they have pushed that deadline out to March 31st. So I think that's a clear indication that along with January 20th, with the Trump inauguration, the water protectors have dug in for the winter and will be there until the spring.
What do you mean when you say it might go on the rocks? You think the financing will be pulled away from the project?
The indication is that they're not going to sign on the dotted line on December 31st, that they push that deadline out to March 31st. And so to me, in my limited understanding of the financial and corporate realm immersed in the criminal side, it seems to be an indication that they're having cold feet.
That's well said. Angela, before we wind up, because we're coming to the end of our allotted time, is there anything else that you want to share with our audience?
I just want to continue to ask for people's support, financial support for the Oyate camp and all the camps, and so that people can have the resources they need to get through this very hard winter that is, you know, seems to be one big storm a week. People need 4x4 vehicles. People need more snowmobiles just for the safety. Wood is a constant battle trying to get enough wood. Find sellers in North Dakota who have wood that they're willing to sell to water protectors. There's a lot of prejudice that is continuing to escalate in Bismarck and Mandan just for people having the status of being a water protector. Services are being denied and people's safety is at risk when they go to town for supplies. And so I just ask for people's prayers for that.
Well, how do people support you? Is there a website they can go to?
They can go to our website, waterprotectorlegal.org, and they can get more information about how to support the legal collective in particular, but also to keep in mind that there are many organizations that have sprung up to support this cause, and that all of them, in my opinion, are quite worthy.
Well, Angela, we hope that you get better quickly and that you have a good year. You know, you have our great admiration, you and the people up there. This is one of the most extraordinarily meaningful fights the movement has been into in a long, long time. The people up there are really protecting everything, humans and other species, and you have our total support, and we look forward to speaking with you again. Get better, feel well, and have a good new year.
Well, Pita Tonka, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to spend this morning with you.
Thank you. Take it easy, Angela. Bye-bye.
Doksha.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
National Security Director James Clapper was being questioned by Congress. The news media was there. He looked the camera right in the eye. The question was, does the NSA spy on Americans? He answered, not wittingly. This was a lie. The NSA was spying on every computer keystroke and telephone call made by every American. Edward Snowden blew the whistle on this totalitarian practice that turned democracy upside down. Instead of the government serving the people, the government was spying on the people it should be serving. Snowden has been indicted under the 1917 Espionage Act. He's presently living in Russia, stripped of his passport, unable to travel, unable to come home, where he faces decades in prison, or worse. Oscar-winning film director Oliver Stone's just-released movie Snowden tells Edward Snowden's story. We are joined today by film writer Zachary Sklar, who, with Oliver Stone, wrote the film script to Stone's Oscar-winning movie JFK, which tells the story of the CIA assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Zachary Sklar is a screenwriter, journalist, author, and editor. Sklar has edited numerous nonfiction books about U.S. intelligence, including the number one bestselling On the Trail of the Assassins by Jim Garrison, from which the film JFK was adapted. Prophets of War, Inside the Secret U.S.-Israeli Arms Network by former Israeli intelligence operative Ari Ben-Menashe, and Deadly Deceits, My 25 Years in the CIA by former CIA case officer Ralph McGehee.
Zach, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Now, those of us in the studio have all seen the film Snowden when it came out this weekend. Can you tell us what the film is about and why is it important?
The film is the human side of the story of Edward Snowden, who worked for the CIA and the NSA and revealed thousands of previously secret documents that showed massive surveillance that the NSA was engaged in. Of course, this received a lot of news coverage in daily newspapers and in the excellent Academy Award-winning documentary Citizen 4. But what this film that Oliver Stone has made does that's different is that it shows the human being behind the news stories. It shows the evolution of his consciousness from someone who was a true believer, a patriot in the narrowest sense of America, right or wrong, to someone who started to see what the United States intelligence agencies were actually engaged in. And because he was a very intelligent guy, started to put two and two together and realize what he was participating in. It took a long time, but his consciousness evolved, and eventually he could not live with the secrecy that he'd been under, and he revealed these documents, not directly, but to the press, thinking that the journalists could decide what was newsworthy and what was not. He didn't think that was his decision, but he thought that in a democracy, an informed public was essential. So what this film does is it goes beyond the headlines, and it goes beyond all the character assassination that the government and the media engaged in initially when Snowden made these revelations. They called him a traitor and liar and so forth.
Zachary Sklar, can you give us some sense of the evolution of Ed Snowden's thinking? He started out after 9/11 joining the special forces. And then he ended up doing what he did. How did he go from being kind of a naive, idealistic person to doing what many people regard as an extraordinary act of patriotism and decency?
Well, like many whistleblowers, Snowden began as a young idealist, and I would say a fairly naive one. Believing in all the cliches of American democracy, liberty, freedom, and justice for all, and all that stuff, and was willing to put his life on the line for that. He joined the Army, Special Forces, but he could not continue with that because his legs were broken, and they basically said he could not do it physically. So he joined. He was a computer genius, self-taught, and he joined the CIA. They recognized pretty quickly that this man had great talent that they could use. And he joined the CIA and started working on these programs, secret programs, with some of which he helped design. He also wanted to get involved with special ops, black ops, you know, more in the field kind of stuff. And the film shows him getting involved in some of the stuff that the CIA actually engages in, but he found that he couldn't stomach it because they were doing things like setting up, there's a banker from Pakistan that they set up because they want to blackmail him, and they get him drunk, and they almost kill him, and they blackmail him about his daughter and so forth. This kind of stuff he really couldn't stomach. He was a young, idealistic guy, and he really didn't understand at that point the human consequences of what the CIA was up to. He then went back to Washington, and through his relationship with his girlfriend, who was much more skeptical about these things, he started to realize that the domestic surveillance was pervasive, including spying on him and his girlfriend. There's a particularly vivid scene where he realizes that through her webcam that the NSA can actually monitor what's going on in their own home. So he starts to see these things, and then he's tapped to go to Hawaii and work on cyber counterintelligence operations against China and design programs, and he realizes that he sees what the NSA is up to, including the live surveillance through telephones of people suspected of being terrorists, and then through drones, these people are blown up. He witnesses all this, so that he starts to see that there are terrible human consequences to what is going on. He knows that just because a telephone is tracked, it doesn't mean that the person that being tracked is a terrorist, that in fact they can't identify who that is, or that there will not be what they call collateral damage, meaning innocent civilians killed by drones. So all these things start to add up, and he starts to realize that his own domestic life is being watched. And he finally reaches a point where he also realizes that this is worldwide. It's not just the U.S. They're not just surveilling people who are suspected terrorists. They're actually surveilling everyone. Everyone in the entire world is under their surveillance. They're monitoring phones. They're monitoring the internet. They basically know, and when I say they, I'm talking about the NSA and the CIA, that they are watching everything and recording everything that basically everyone is doing. They know, where you've been. They know who you've talked to. They know what your banking situation is. They know what you've bought, what movies you've seen, what you've watched on television, what you've done on the internet. All these things are recorded. So he started to realize the implications of this, and at a point he just broke. He couldn't take it anymore, and he felt that these things were way beyond anything that he considered to be a democratic society, and he felt that the people should know about it. So that's what happened, and he revealed the documents, not directly, but through journalists that he trusted, Laura Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, and Ewan McCaskill of The Guardian, and also The Washington Post, and The New York Times, and they ended up printing those things, some of which were very, very damning, including that the NSA was monitoring the phones and emails of the presidents of Mexico and Brazil, of German Chancellor Merkel, and all this kind of stuff. And it became a huge scandal. Of course, he was immediately labeled a traitor by the government. And that's a way of covering up and also trying to discredit and do character assassination, which is a familiar pattern for any whistleblower has to go through that.
Zach, we want to talk about that, but first I want to say that it's been 25 years since you co-wrote JFK with Oliver Stone. What has changed during this time? And is the film Snowden a departure, or is it a continuation of Stone's earlier work?
Well, I think the main theme of the film JFK, the thing that struck a raw nerve with people, was not the details of the Kennedy assassination, but the underlying theme was that there was a secret, invisible government that was unaccountable to the people, paid for by us, but totally unaccountable. That has only gotten worse in the 25 years since that movie was released. I think people were horrified by that. It was like, The Wizard of Oz, when the little dog pulls the curtain back, and for many people that was the moment when they realized that there was this unaccountable secret government going on that was running things, and there was no way to stop them. And people were horrified by that. But I think that what's happened since then is it's gotten much, much worse. I mean, the technology has, just exploded. And, you know, in the old days, the FBI wanted to monitor people. They're out there with agents, and they tap phones, and they actually watch people. They go outside. I mean, when I was a kid, my parents were surveilled, and they were actually physically sitting outside in a car watching who came to my birthday parties. Then they would compile all these, cards and documents, to create a file on people. Well, that's child's play compared to what's going on now. I mean, now they basically have the technology to know everything that everyone is doing in the entire world. So the secrecy has only increased, and that's what I think got the government so upset about Snowden's revelations, was that he broke that veil of secrecy. I think that has been Oliver Stone's main concern. I think that he is that his work has gone back and forth over the years, but I think that his main theme has been to reveal the secrecy of government and to try to make it more accountable. So I think this film is one of his strongest films. I think it goes back to his earlier work. And he, in a sense, is like Snowden. You know, Oliver was a true believer also. He was a Goldwater Republican when he was a teenager, and he dropped out of Yale to go volunteer to fight in Vietnam. He believed in all that, and it was only through his experiences, just like Snowden, that his consciousness changed. And though he was never in a position like Snowden to know exactly what the secret government was doing, he certainly could see what was going on in Vietnam, and he did his share of revealing the truth through his films. I think that this is just a continuation of that from his earlier work.
It's a stunning film, the film Snowden. Absolutely riveting. And we urge our listeners to go see it. And Zach, you worked closely with Oliver Stone when you wrote the film script to the movie JFK. And of course, that movie stands up to this day as being a very insightful movie about the power of the CIA, and would lead people to conclude, as I did then and still do believe, that it was the CIA that assassinated John Kennedy. Now, the hero of the movie JFK was Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney who prosecuted one of the people who were involved in the conspiracy. And Garrison tells that story. And it struck me that Garrison, I thought, had a lot in common with Snowden. And I wanted to ask you about what parallels you could draw.
Yes, I think there are parallels. And I think there are parallels with many whistleblowers. I've worked with several in the past, not just Garrison, but also Ralph McGehee, who worked for 25 years in the CIA and then wrote a book about those his experiences. Ari Ben-Menashe, who worked, with the CIA as an Israeli undercover agent. These are all whistleblowers, and they have one thing in common. First of all, they're very intelligent, all of them. They all began as idealists, and I think a little bit naive, believing in all the cliches of what America stood for, and Israel at that time, for Ari Ben-Menashe in his case. With Garrison, it was clear that, and none of these people, I mean, Snowden, Garrison, they are not flaming radicals by any means. If anything, they're quite conservative and believe in the traditional values of America and so forth. But all of them are extremely courageous. They're all willing to volunteer and put their life on the line for their country. And all of them are changed by their experience. They are smart enough to see what's going on, and they change their consciousness as a result of that. And it leads to a sense of outrage and betrayal. And then they are also, both Snowden and Garrison and these others as well, are strong enough and courageous enough to stand up and speak the truth, regardless of the personal consequences. I think there's a deep morality in all of them, which, it seems old-fashioned almost in the society we live in now, They want to do what's right, and they are willing to take the consequences, whatever they may be, for their personal situation.
Zach, the qualities you've just described to me also sum up what it means to be a patriot. And there's a debate going on right now with the ACLU calling for President Obama to pardon Snowden. We've always felt he was a hero. What do you think the general public, the more they learn about Ed Snowden, do you think many will come to view him as a true patriot?
Yes, I think what happens with all these whistleblowers is that initially there's an onslaught of media and government criticism of them. That character assassination is what I would call it. And it is an orchestrated campaign. We know this from Jim Garrison's experience, because we got the CIA memo that actually outlined how they were going to use the media assets to slander him, to say that he was a Southern politician, that he was a liar, that he messed with evidence. You know, there were all kinds of accusations made against him that were all outlined in this memo. So we know that it was an orchestrated campaign to use the assets that the CIA had in the media to plant articles about him that with these accusations. So I have no doubt that that is continuing as a program, and that every time there is a whistleblower, that's exactly what happens, and they get called a traitor, and it's a distraction to keep people from realizing what it is that these whistleblowers have revealed. I had, initially conversations with very intelligent colleagues who immediately said to me, "Oh, Snowden is a traitor. He should never have gone to Russia. He should have stayed and gone on trial if he wanted to stand up for his convictions," and so forth. I think as time has gone on, and we've seen much more come out, and there's been much more considered opinion about what he did. And this movie Citizen 4 helped enormously, and I think this film Snowden will also help enormously. That people start to understand, they see that this is not done as an act of spying or trying to give secrets to some other country. This is done as an act of what he considered to be patriotism, to reveal to the public the truth about what our country, our government was doing. You know, there is a campaign by the ACLU, led by the ACLU and I believe Amnesty International, that is petitioning to support Snowden and bring him home and have the charges dropped. I think that listeners should definitely go online and sign those petitions. The more people, the more public support he has, the more likely that he can actually get some justice in this situation. You know, there are a lot of people who just don't pay much attention, who sort of see a headline, they hear that Snowden is a traitor, and that's all they know. And I think it's a big service that this film has done in that it humanizes and it shows exactly where this guy was coming from and what he did.
And we'll have a link to that petition on lawanddisorder.org. But Zach, we want to thank you so much for your time, your insights, and everything that you've done to help in related efforts.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Zachary Sklar. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.